And so when you think about it as a system, you know, our bodies are like sort of the ultimate supply chain, if you think about it, shepherding all the different nutrients through our body and waste through our body. But it's a really tightly run logistics system at the end of the day.
And now from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Today, we sat down with Christine Lemke, co-founder, co-CEO, and president at Evidation Health. And we discuss how patients experience managing their chronic conditions outside of their visits to the clinic that drove Christine's passion in starting Evidation. Christine is not new in the entrepreneurship world. She started a company before in a machine learning platform for mobile phone that was sold to yellowpages.com before she started Evidation. Here is our conversation with Christine. Well, thank you, Christine, for joining me today. It's such a glorious day in San Francisco today. And you are probably the third or fourth Christine that I know in this country. So,
wow.
I don't know that many Christine. There's a lot of Christina. But
Christine's got to stick together.
Well, thank you for joining me. And I talked to Malay Gandhi a few weeks ago, and we talked briefly about your story. And I always wanted to have you on our podcast because I think you have quite an amazing story to tell. And so finally, I got my chance, so I can't pass up on that one. So here we are.
Thank you. So
I'd like to start maybe a little bit about, because you have a really interesting background. You started off not really in healthcare, but somehow you are in healthcare. Tell us about how you end up choosing this healthcare route.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I should preface it with, this is my third startup I've co-founded in my career. And the line that I draw between all the different companies I've started is, I've always been really interested in data and analytics, even before data and analytics were cool. I think I studied entrepreneurship and finance in my undergrad. And one of my entrepreneurship professors said, "Hey, come join my startup." And I was literally employee number one at that company. And it was in the most unsexy field you could possibly imagine. Healthcare is cool in comparison, which is supply chain management. So imagine all the e-commerce is on the rise. This is like 1999, 2000. And all these products are being shipped out. And nobody knew what to do with them when somebody wanted to return them. And so this company was called Returns Online, and we were, it was a really rich data problem. We were trying to understand why people were returning things, analyzing that data, trying to optimize processes. We actually bought a warehouse outside of Atlanta, Georgia, and using a lot of data to optimize that warehouse, and just got really into, oh, there's sensors tied to all these boxes and barcodes and all this data is coming out, and isn't it cool? So just swimming in a lot of data.
Sound supply chain really fun, though.
Supply chain is actually like a fascinating data problem at the end of the day. It was one of the first industries that had super high frequency digital exhaust data that you could analyze and use that analysis to really optimize what was going on inside of a warehouse or what was going on inside of a delivery system overall. And so when you think about it as a system, you know, our bodies are like sort of the ultimate supply chain, if you think about it, shepherding all the different nutrients through our body and waste through our body. But it's a really tightly run logistics system at the end of the day. You could even abstract it to that level, but have always since then been sort of obsessed with, you know, emerging sources of data and trying to characterize unique things with that emerging source of data. And so that's really what brought me to healthcare. Is I sort of surfed along the different data waves, one being supply chain, the next being sort of mobile advertising. Hey, if you could, you know, take our phones and take a look at all the location data emanating from our phones and people moving around the world, maybe we could tell you a thing or two about human behavior. And if you could say, oh, I'm a frequent business traveler, then maybe Hertz might be interested in selling you an ad. And so you have the sharpest minds in machine learning, all these amazing data people being paid, you know, for their brains to be focused on advertising. What a shame. And so all that is great. It can make you a lot of money. It can make you a successful business, et cetera. But what a shame to put some of our sharpest minds on that problem versus on something that truly matters, which back in 2011-12, I thought healthcare would be a better place to focus some of that energy, effort, and expertise.
Okay.
So well, here I am.
Before we dive in into that, I was just thinking about, from your story that you kind of jumped in starting a company right off your undergraduate, which, you know, and then also in finance, usually at least all my finance friends, they end up going to work in
bankers.
Bankers. And did you all, you study entrepreneurship as well, but is this something that you kind of know all along, or is this by luck that you just meet the right people at the right time?
So I grew up very, very poor. My father was a Lutheran pastor in the middle of South Dakota. We grew up on food stamps and government issued powdered milk and American cheese. And the reason I studied finance in college is because I thought that would give me a job that could pay the bills and maybe pay my parents' bills too. So I did not at all think I'd pop out of undergrad and start a company, which seems like a very difficult road. It never even honestly crossed my mind. But
is
I had
more of a pragmatic, practical approach.
Yeah, I thought I would come out and work for a bank. I thought that would be a really well-paying job. I could take care of myself and my student debt and my family, by taking a safe job at a bank and getting paid a lot of money. That's what I was optimizing for out of undergrad. And then you realize at one point that, and maybe this is a little bit of a control freak in me, but can control your own destiny to a certain degree in entrepreneurship. Now, that is not at all true, by the way, but that's what you think when you're 21, 22 years old. And when my professor at school said, hey, I'm starting this company, and he was a really seasoned, experienced entrepreneur, I just sort of leapt at the chance to learn from someone so seasoned and to see if I could eventually do it myself.
I mean, you moved and you said you grew up in South Dakota and you did your undergraduate in Seattle.
Yes.
That must be quite a change, culture shock and everything else.
Yeah, it was. But I was probably the only adopted gay Korean in South Dakota. And so I was used to being odd person out. So taking a leap to the coast was the first time I felt like I actually fit in somewhere.
It does make a huge difference, right? When you feel like you fit in. And then...
Yeah, that's right. It gives you... Better. It makes you a little weird, I think. It gives you both sort of... fitting in gives you both the confidence to explore, and feeling like you've been an outsider your whole life also gives you that added confidence to feel okay even if you've strayed. So it's sort of this duality, I think, that works for me.
I think also the fact that you're an outsider also gives you a different perspective about, you have certain way of looking at things that probably in the insider people never have to practice.
You feel very comfortable having a very different opinion and viewpoint than other people, and maybe too much so. So, yeah.
How does that translate to how you conduct your leadership and identifying problems and how to solve the problems?
It makes me, in maybe a healthy and sometimes unhealthy way, reject common wisdom. And common tropes and common advice. One example of this is, people said when we started the company, all of you have to be in the same city, same time zone. You all have to work in the same place together. And indeed, we tried that for a little bit of time, but then all four co-founders sort of spread out a bit and we were just fine. And people told us that was a terrible way to do it. You'll never succeed, et cetera. This is Evidation when we started Evidation. So it just gives you a more independent way of thinking through problems that might be unique to your situation and makes you a little bit more open to the idea that the common tropes out there maybe don't apply and you should think really about your situation, your context, and tailor your solutions to those things instead of just listening blindly to everybody else.
And how does I assume the people who provide you that advice are your advisor, and oftentimes, how do you navigate that, right? Oftentimes people who you seek for advice, and then here you are saying like, you know, I don't think that's not going to work.
Yeah, sometimes you have to reject the advice.
Right. Totally. Because you do, you can't just take everybody's advice, but I think there's a way on how to do it. And so that people don't feel rushed off. Because you do want to get them on to advise you on other things.
100%. I think when most people, I think even when I give advice or when the best advisors I've had have said, hey, this is my situation and this is what I did versus basically telling me what to do. And there's so much more to learn when somebody prefaces the advice, which this was my situation and my context, and this is the series of decisions I made, just so you know. And so the advisors I tend to really pay attention to are the ones who understand that context really, truly matters when giving and receiving advice. And so when I don't take their advice, oftentimes I can come back and say, yep, thank you for your advice. Here was my situation. Here's the decision I made. And here's what I learned from you. And people are extremely receptive to that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, you know, to have... especially somebody who come in with saying like, this is my situation, then when you bring your situation, oftentimes is different and they can be more understanding. And then you don't burn any, relationship that you want to keep them.
Yeah. The best relationships are dialogues at the end of the day anyway. So
yeah,
that's what I strive for.
Okay. So from your first entrepreneurship, the first startup you did, and then how do you make one after another? You know, this is your third startup.
We just become unemployable, really.
Just for some of you guys who have not seen you in person, you're a young person and you've gone through three startups already.
Yeah. At this point, I'm unemployable, like literally. So the only way to have a job is for me to start a company, at a certain point. I think... The leap is not for everyone, I would say. And you have to think carefully about why you're doing what you're doing. I would say that some people, it feels like there's a calling that they have. Similar to my dad, who is a pastor, felt called and compelled to do the work by some invisible, force or something inside of him. And so some people have this. Some people have this independent streak or entrepreneurial mindset where this is their calling and they're never going to be happy until they satisfy that calling and just do it. For other people, this is more calculated, I think. And then again, for other people, it's something that they feel, I have this problem, nobody is solving for it for me, and I just have to solve it, like, period. And so there are maybe the messages, there are lots of ways to end up starting a company. What I try to maybe advise against is, I think in my experience as an entrepreneur, the folks and my peer set, the folks who I think have planned it like a career move have been the ones where it's been the hardest journey versus the ones who feel like it's either a calling or feel like there's a burning problem nobody's solving and they just feel compelled to solve it. Mm-hmm. The ones who plan it like it's a career move, I think, might have a harder time dealing with the ups and downs of what entrepreneurship can be.
Because there's a lot of uncertainties. And if you plan your career, usually that is not the kind of personality.
That's right. In Silicon Valley for a while, it felt like people were just sort of planning, I have to be an operator, a startup entrepreneur for 2 years, and then I'm going to go get my venture capital job. And then, it can feel like that sometimes here. But I'm not sure that's always the best path for someone.
Uh-huh. Well, I think with this whole COVID-19, maybe that's the lesson learned too, that certain things is beyond your control.
There's your good news of the day.
So tell us a little bit more about Evidation. What gave you the idea, and has the idea changed
in what it is trying to accomplish.
So the tagline of Evidation is, we measure health in everyday life. So we're really trying to understand what happens to a person outside their clinic visit or outside their doctor's office, and how they're experiencing disease onset and progression. And with the proliferation of wearable devices and digital things that we're interacting with on a daily basis, on an hourly basis, on a minute-by-minute basis nowadays, there are clear health signals if you take that data and sort of look at it as in a whole. And so one example of this is we did a study with Apple and Eli Lilly last year on understanding cognitive decline through measures as varied as your typing speed, your voice and speech, the way that you interacted with your phone apps, and other types of metrics that are collected just as you go about your activities of daily living, to understand cognitive decline, the onset and the progression of it. And so our company is really trying to understand these at a very detailed level, detailed enough so that we can understand whether a therapy might be working for someone or not, or whether we can find the earliest signals of disease onset. And then everyone, it has a different disease trajectory, yet in the healthcare system, in many ways, they're treated like they have the same disease trajectory. And so we know that being able to use this finer grain data to discriminate between disease trajectories could be quite beneficial in getting the right care to the right person at the right time. So really, the company is in pursuit of that particular mission. And the idea really came from, everybody has their own health journey. If you ask each of my three co-founders why they started the company, they'll give you a different, very deeply personal answer about either family situations and people suffering from health issues or themselves. In my case, it was myself. I have a difficult to diagnose chronic disease or chronic illness called ankylosing spondylitis.
And what is that?
Yeah, exactly. What is that? It's an autoimmune disease that's more commonly found in white males. And so it took 10 years to diagnose the condition in me because, it couldn't be this. I didn't match the demographic profile for this particular disease, even though I suffered all the telltale symptoms of it for many, many years. It's an arthritic condition. So, parts of your spinal cord tend to fuse together eventually. It's something that's painful every day. I'm used to it on a daily basis now, but it's something that causes flare-ups and pain almost every day. And progressively, it'll get worse, but I'll be fine. But wanting to understand that disease a little bit more and knowing that it was very functional in nature, I just had the intuition we could use a lot of this digital data to understand my own progression. And what a shame that nobody really knows how to do that yet.
So I just want to ask a bit more detail about the collaboration with the study that you're doing with Apple and Lilly. Is that because they have the device, they have the keyboard to type, the phone, and then Lilly has the therapeutic medication. And where do you come in? Like, do you analyze the data that the Apple already collect? And what do you have?
So in this particular case, it was a prospective study. So we ran it as a research study. We recruited people through sites, so memory centers across the United States. And all this work has been published. And we equipped people with iPhones, with iPads, with watches, with sleep devices called Bedits, so that we could track all sorts of things about their activities of daily living. And then during the study, we already knew their diagnosis. So we already knew whether they had MCI, which is mild cognitive impairment, or whether they were not impaired, or whether they had signs and symptoms of mild Alzheimer's disease already. And then during the course of the study, we could normalize that data against cognitive tests that were broadly accepted as a gold standard diagnostic assist types of test.
Okay.
So really it was taking the data from those provided devices collecting it and analyzing it against cognitive tests and their diagnostic data.
And then Lilly, as a result of this study, what decision did they make?
Yeah, so that's an ongoing dialogue that we're having with not just Lilly, but several different parties of, okay, what's next? How do we use the findings of this study and really extend it both into clinical care and into products? We think there's broad applicability here that if you could understand your cognitive health much better, this set of measures could be baked into everything. I mean, just think of all the disease areas, not just Alzheimer's disease, but that could benefit from some measure of cognitive health to measure side effects of different therapies, to measure side effects of oncology treatments. And then ultimately, yes, to understand Alzheimer's a little bit better, because many of the therapies for Alzheimer's need to be delivered very early in the cycle of cognitive decline. And so if you aren't picking up that earliest signal of cognitive decline, a lot of the therapies that are going to start to come to market are going to be useless in the later stages of cognitive decline. So ultimately, we hope that these measures will be used to diagnose people earlier and screen people earlier for treatment.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping med tech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
So the evidation, how do you think, I mean, you know, you have that autoimmune disorder. Do you see that is at least coming your way to help what you're going through? And do you have any plan on how to address that?
You know, I've learned that it's not always just about me, you know, that other people have problems too. And so that's something you quickly learn. Maybe the problem that you have might have been the spark for the business idea, but when you dive into it, there's a lot more impact you could make in other disease areas. Eventually, we'll wind our way back to ankylosing spondylitis. But today, we're focused on more broad therapeutic areas that have broader reach and impact for folks, which do include a lot of different autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. We've done work in atopic dermatitis, allergy type 2, et cetera, diabetes, which is not an autoimmune disorder, at least type 2. But, you know, the company has grown in a good way. So,
right. So the company has grown. Now looking back when you started to where it is now, I'm sure your role also evolved and the company's, you set the company's culture and how do you do all that to keep it to the way you think it would be successful for the growth of the company?
Company culture is really hard. I wish I could say I have all sorts of really rich advice because we nailed it, but we haven't. It's been a tricky road. One complication for, I think, health technology companies is trying to marry two very different company cultures, one from the tech side and one from the healthcare side. The two, and I've spoken about this before, but the two segments use the same language but mean different things. So that's one complicating factor. The two segments have really different views of what risk is. In tech, the famous Facebook saying is move fast and break things. And that is maybe famous because it's largely emblematic, I think, of how tech companies themselves operate. Like don't make the same mistake twice. I think make new mistakes is another trope that's common in tech culture, because in software, you can always sort of patch and fix things if you make a mistake. And it's more important to move quickly than it is to make sure everything is perfectly tested and audited and high quality and, you know, all those different things. You're going to break a few eggs along the way and it's going to be fine because you can always like mop them up after. We're finding out that that's actually not so true on a societal level, but that's something else for another conversation. in the healthcare side, if you move fast and break things, you break people, which is a very bad thing. And so there's more of a culture of caution, more risk-averse culture. There's more a culture of experience really, really matters over, you know, tech culture, which is, yeah, your experience doesn't really matter. If you're young and hungry and you don't have any experience, come right over. Like,
we'll figure it out.
You can push code in the next hour. You know? Facebook literally brags about having all their new engineers push code their first day. So, which I can't imagine that happening in a medical device company or a therapeutic company. And so bridging those two cultures has been tricky, and we haven't done it perfectly, but we've certainly tried.
What have you tried that it works? What have you tried that doesn't work?
So we have one particular value at the company that we've had to modify over the years. The original value said, it was this principle of challenge one another and assume good intent. So, and the idea behind that was don't interpret everything somebody says at you in a very negative way, because things just escalate very quickly, especially if you think you're using the same words for things, but they mean different things to different people. You can see how these escalations can get out of hand like very quickly. And so the original value is, you know, challenge one another and assume good intent. And we've had to modify that over the years because it turns out putting the onus on someone to interpret the good intent was actually the wrong thing. Now the value reads challenge each other and state your good intent. So now the onus is on the person saying something or asserting an idea to state their intent up front, which has made conversations like a lot easier. You can imagine, you know, this turning into a toddler fight where one person says, "You're supposed to assume good intent," you know, and it just, anyway, "This is your fault. Even though I had an extremely sarcastic tone, you were supposed to assume good intent." we had to tweak and modify over the years, but that's been one value that's helped bridge the two cultures for sure.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's a lot of it is communication, and what makes us very interesting is because we are not robot. If it's robot, everything is just literal. They don't hear all this different tone, and every human has their own little experience, therefore baggage. And again, it's funny how human interact.
Oh, filters that we form over the years, you know? So yeah.
It's culture wise, it's culture and experience, and which make it very interesting and bring a lot of different talent that way. But, you know, I guess you cannot have it all.
Yeah, there's everything is a double-sided, you know, everything is a dual-edged sword. So I wouldn't give up that richness for the life of me, but there are challenges that are associated with lots of different views at the table.
And you get all the robots in the room. So, but, you know, now like the trend, there's a lot of technology and healthcare and the science is all people who, I like what you're saying, they can say the same thing, but with different meaning. And it's just, it takes time to pause to say, wait a second, that's what you mean. And I think also in a startup world, everything moves so fast.
Yes.
Sometimes you don't have the chance to pause. It's like, wait a second, that's, and then you just run with it.
Miscommunication compounded by speed equals disaster.
Yeah. So. But do you find that make it even harder? Because as a team get bigger, then that's usually a lot of the more miscommunication happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Scaling the company while still trying to maintain this diversity of thought and balance is very, very, very tricky. And so you almost have to nauseatingly as a leader indoctrinate, you know, people with some of the things that you figured out can smooth those interactions. You know, you have to also try to, and feedback is really hard for people. you have to sort of have this culture of feedback, 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 literally after every interaction. Hey, what could I have done better? Hey, like, you know, and you have to start that as the leader.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that it filters down. And, you know, once people get used to the feedback cycle and it's hard at first, then it also reduces some of the friction too.
I think as a leader, you're right. I think as a leader, you need to provide that safety for people to provide feedback. But I, you know, it can be hard to hear for some more than others sometimes, but, it's again, we are not robots. We have feelings.
Right. We have feelings.
So by the way, congratulations. Like, you guys recently raised a big round.
We did. Thank you.
I mean, the announcement always comes late. I'm sure that you kind of have celebrated before we see the news. And so what's next with that, you know, $45 million? What's next for Evidation? What are you trying to accomplish?
You know, we are only halfway through our mission, our original mission at the company. And so we're lucky to be in a place where we have committed investors who really have believed in the long vision here. The original vision of the company was always about virtual, something we're calling internally called virtual health, which is really this idea. So in research today, one of the advantages we have as a company is we do pretty much entirely decentralized research. So it's something I'll crudely say, we get samples on the ground and we do research in the cloud. You know, we conveniently get samples of things, both digital data and some biological data from people within the comfort and safety and convenience of their own homes. And then they ship it back to us and we do all the analytics and research, you know, in the cloud. And you can imagine a future where more of that happens in our care delivery system too, where samples are collected on the ground and care is in the cloud. And so without saying too much, you'll see Evidation enter phase two of our original mission, which is to start realizing our dream of true virtual health in the market and try to facilitate that. And it's been tricky because the healthcare system, at least in the United States, is full of all sorts of crazy incentive structures that are hard to figure out as a new entrepreneur in the space. It's definitely not for the faint of heart. It's taken me years to detangle even some of it. And I feel like I'm still learning something new every day. But that's really what we hope to accomplish with this next set of investment.
That's great. I'm looking forward to see what's that's next. So before we wrap up, I mean, everything, I think there's always silver lining for everything. COVID-19, what do you think is, you know, what's a good thing will come out from this COVID-19, especially in the healthcare space?
I think this acceleration of making healthcare a lot more accessible and convenient to people whenever they'd like it is massively accelerated with COVID-19. I think all the things that are going on in telehealth right now, I think all the bending over backwards to ensure people are healthy at home by outfitting folks with the right set of digital tools to be able to monitor themselves and keep their physician in the loop will be a huge net positive for the entire healthcare system. And COVID-19 has grossly accelerated that.
And do you think, how do you, for, you know, I think sometimes we always assume that a lot of people are connected. We are all very connected, but there's a lot of population in this country who, as much as we like to think we are United States of America, many of them are not that connected yet. How do we address that health equity?
Yeah, I think by showing that it saves, and this is because we operate in a capitalist society and we have a capitalist healthcare system, showing that it saves money to connect those people, that there is a true business case for connecting folks to deliver more preventative, proactive care. And I think there is, and we want to prove it. I think that's what will help with some of that digital divide. And that's what will help with some of the health inequity that we all have. The promise of technology to democratize, you know, access to better care at scale, I think is true. Like, I'm an optimist about that. And now is the time to, you know, demonstrate it, especially given the COVID circumstances we're in. And I think the value's there. I'm firmly convinced the value's there.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your story and your insight.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Casper Mossman, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.